All hell was let loose at the New York Times the other day, and I can only imagine the glut of telephone calls, the frantic switchboard operators, as the indignation came roaring in like the Mississippi in flood. The Times committed a boner, boo-boo, or clangor of the first clang. They identified a neutron as a neutrino. Can you imagine? Now, this required a humiliating retraction or correction the next day, and it appeared in the weirdest form. Opening my paper on Wednesday morning, I saw what at first looked like a technical explanation of what was happening in the World Series, the annual baseball championship with which we've been obsessed during the past 10 days, to the exclusion of such trivia as SALT II, the general alarm over rising interest rates, and how low Jimmy Carter's sinking in the polls. The apologetic diagram showed what looked like 8 baseballs, 4 in the top picture, 4 in the bottom. They were arranged at the 4 corners of an invisible rectangle, with arrows swooping out from the center to each of them. In the middle was a faint star surrounded by short, sharp spokes, exactly the way they indicate the days in the head of Andy Capp when Mrs. Capp fetches him a clout on the chops. This, by the way, was called in the diagram an energetic collision. Before I put my glasses on, I swear to you that this was an illustration of the art of John Candelaria, the pitcher of the Pittsburgh Pirates, who on Tuesday night saved his team for the decisive final game. And I'll bet that many an eager boy saw the diagram and was proud to think that the Times had had the wit to illustrate in this fashion 2 of Candelaria's deadly weapons, the arrows swooping out from center to produce either a curveball or a sinker. Well, people to whom baseball is as much of a mystery as atomic physics will be relieved to hear that what the Times was apologizing for was a gross mistake it had made the previous day in explaining just why Weinberg and Glashow of Harvard and Abdus Salam of London and Trieste had won the Nobel Prize in Physics. I don't think we need detain ourselves very long over the details of their great achievement. If the Times says, which it did, that these great men have evolved a theory which, and I'm quoting, is so profound as to affect man's perception of existence, that surely should be enough for the rest of us. Enough for me, anyway, to end the unbearable suspense you must be suffering by saying that in the 2 diagrams, 4 baseballs to each, the ball at the southwest corner of the first diagram, labeled charged current, was identified as neutrino, zero or negative charge, which required the reprinting next day of the whole picture to show that same harmless ball correctly identified as neutron, zero or negative charge. I hope now that everything is quite clear. What this did to me was to convince me that knowledge has become so specialized that there's no point anymore in the presence even of a semi-expert of pretending to know anything about anything. I used to think in the old days that Americans were much more knowledgeable than Englishmen, for instance, about medicine, because they used with enviable flipness exact medical terms like rhinitis or congested sinuses, where Englishmen tended to go around grumbling about their catarrh or sniffles. I remember becoming so ashamed of my lumpish ignorance about such things that I stopped talking about my lumbago or rheumatics and learned to toss off words like sacroiliac, muscle spasm, and slipped disc. Years later, a back expert told me that a slipped disc is a meaningless phrase. It took some years to discover that the ordinary American, the layman, was no more knowledgeable than his English counterpart. He simply yielded to the national love of Latin and Greek, especially if he knew no Latin or Greek. Thus, I was enormously impressed when I heard somebody say, casually, at a cocktail party, that he'd suffered a lesion on his clavicle. I tiptoed off to the dictionary to learn about this horrendous and exotic affliction. What do you think? He'd hurt his collarbone. Lately, anybody who has an itchy eyelid announces he has blepharitis. It used to be, and I imagine it's still so in England or Australia or South Africa, Ireland, that when you had a pain and went to the doctor, a friend would say, "What did he do for you?" And you'd say, "He gave me a pill." No longer. Not in this country. You're undergoing chemotherapy. Quite simply, literally, this means treatment by a chemical. Well, everything you put in your mouth, from a hamburger to an aspirin, is a chemical. And I have no shame in declaring that my favorite American form of chemotherapy is a chocolate milkshake. And if you think I'm being facetious, let me remind you, what may for the moment have slipped your mind, that in 1502, Columbus took back cocoa beans to Spain, where people added sugar and water and guzzled the stuff to their great and secret delight. For I notice a baffling item in this story. It says here that for nearly 100 years the Spaniards kept their secret. Why? Why? It took the English, soon after 1700, to add milk to the powdered bean and popularize what became known as chocolate houses. By the way, the idea of chocolate baked into blocks and gobbled in theaters, preferably during the tensest scenes of the play, was a long way off, and even then has remained a habit peculiar to the English. Chocolate houses spread around Europe. And in 1713 there appeared what for many years has been one of my favorite books, and one I incessantly recommend to Americans who believe that good medicine started no later than the discovery of penicillin. It is a work, and still a classic work, by one Bernardino Ramazzini, an Italian, and it's called De Morbis Artificum, of the Diseases of Workers. In other words, this was the first textbook on occupational disease. He goes into what he has noticed about the diseases peculiar to blacksmiths and bakers and miners and midwives, and on through glass workers, farmers, fishermen, painters, stone cutters, many others, all the way to athletes and, not least, scholars. He scolds scholars for sitting up late at night, straining their eyes, weakening their knee joints by sitting all the time, and complaining usually of constipation. He quotes to them an older authority still, Plautus: "Sitting hurts your loins and bowels, staring your eyes." Well, scholars and night owls tend, he says, to sleeplessness. So Ramazzini in 1713 brought them all the good news, the latest, the absolutely sovereign remedy. "There has come in," he announces, "a new drink or draught. It is called chocolate. You mix it with milk and heat it. You take it just before you go to bed. It will soothe the digestion, calm the intellect, and induce sound sleep." If Alfred Nobel, a night owl and an insomniac, had been alive at the time, I'm sure he would have given Ramazzini the Nobel Prize for medicine. So let's have no more sidelong sneers at a mere journalist who has been following Ramazzini's prescription for many years and who sleeps like a top, whatever that means. Another word that's enormously popular in America has been for, I should guess, a couple of decades, is the magic word virus. All suffering people toss it off to explain everything from pneumonia to a head cold and fallen arches. I used to use it myself, till, to my shame, a doctor present, said, "No, I don't think it's a virus. I doubt it has protein coat." That's a stopper, if ever I heard one. Well, I find these days it's better to ask simple questions than to venture a statement of fact in any company that might include an expert. I think the best way out, not to appear to be sulking, but to leave with experts a fleeting impression of intelligence, is Stephen Potter's great recommendation. You remember he was caught in a learned conversation between two experts on Italy, an economist and a priest, who were going on with the most alarming expertise about the social, political, and economic turmoil of present-day Italy. He waited, like an alert cat, for a chance to spring. He'd said nothing so far, and then the priest got off some large generalization about the whole of Italy. Potter piped up for the first time, modestly. "But not, I think, in the South." And the priest darted in. "Absolutely right," he said. Potter never opened his mouth from then on, but the priest thought him an uncommonly perceptive man and invited him to lunch. Another way to cut a figure among strangers, when you don't know what they know about and what they don't, is to fetch along an amiable expert in some abstruse topic and gradually bring the conversation round to that. A few years ago, I was sitting with a party of Americans, mostly not showbiz people, but composers of popular music, theatrical agents, and the like. They were having a very private ball, recalling who wrote what and when, and the rest of the company was very much left mum on the outside, especially one small, modest Englishman present who, I knew, had an encyclopedic knowledge of the specialty they thought was all their own. So, in one momentary pause, I turned, not to the prose, but to my friend, and I said to him, "By the way, who wrote the lyric of Collegiate?" There was a stunned silence from the experts. "Surely," he said, "it was Nat Bonks." And, of course, he was right. From then on, the company treated him with elaborate respect, asking his opinion, fetching him drinks, muttering, "These English are the damnedest people." Well, I imagine there's a trivia name even less well-known than that of the immortal Nat Bonks. He is Clarence Muse. So far as I'm concerned, he wrote the immortal song which Louis Armstrong made his theme, "Way Down Yonder in New Orleans." But he was the first black man to star in a movie. He made in all 219 films, and in practically all of them, he played the kindly, humorous, deferential Negro who became known, and in our day execrated, as Uncle Tom. He died this week in California, an unrepentant, kindly, and modest man, one day before his 90th birthday. I am myself suspicious of people who believe, as a religion, in progress, but some things do not stand still. A black man has just won the Nobel Prize in medicine, and Uncle Tom, at last, is dead.